it's a fucking ship. It's a son of a bitch, y'all, and we're building it. It's gonna take us up into the sky. We don't need the earth, we're gonna fucking fly sky high. Death Star, it's a son of a bitch, y'all. Gonna take us into outer space. Get your shit together, motherfucker. We're gonna start a new human race in the sky.
Now you may witness the firepower of this fully armed and operational movie podcast. Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is the CGI representation of...
Mike DiCrucio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. You know, I may be distracting to you, but it's still a technical achievement that I'm here.
I guess it is, although there's a lot of uncanny valley going on through this Skype call.
Yes, there is.
There's just something slightly off about you. It's the eyes. You got those cold, dead eyes, like a doll's
like
eyes.
Like a doll's eyes.
Now, if you've ever listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we will move on to our featured review, and this week it is, of course, our now annual return into the Star Wars universe. Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Are you excited, Mike?
Oh, yeah. This is the thing that, as awful as the world is, we're entering, you know, we always have the Snyderverse that we talk about.
Right.
The glimpse of hope is we now enter a 3 Marvel movies a year future and a Star Wars movie a year future.
The goal is that if we can make it through the end of every year, at the end of the year, there will always be a Star Wars movie waiting for us.
Yeah. Our little reward for surviving that long.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about Rogue One in a little bit, but first, let's get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
Let's get into some film news. We begin with some DC news. Mike, do you remember a little movie called Suicide Squad?
I think I do.
I think we do. It's sort of a fever dream at this point. It's something that we're pretty sure happened, but it was so bad that we kind of blocked it out of our memories.
Yeah.
I would say, at least for me. Well, I hope you liked Suicide Squad.
Spoiler alert, I didn't.
Because we're getting another movie from David Ayer, the director of Suicide Squad, in the DC Universe. And that movie is Gotham City Sirens. And basically, this is an all-female DC villains movie with Margot Robbie set to return as Harley Quinn. Mike, good idea, bad idea? Give me your thoughts.
I think good idea. Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn was a lot of fun in that movie, in Suicide Squad.
Right.
So why not? Like, at this point, I think DC needs to do any and everything. Like...
See, that's the thing. I feel like DC has been doing any and everything. It's been throwing everything at the wall, and nothing has stuck.
That's, you know? Yeah. I mean, that is a good point.
You know, on paper, I think a Gotham City Sirens movie, like an all-female DC villains movie, that sounds like a cool idea. And Margot Robbie was great as Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad, so there's that. But Suicide Squad was terrible, Mike.
It was. Yeah, you're right.
It was so bad, and David Ayer directed it, and now he's going to be directing this, and it's like, why?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, David Ayer should definitely not be allowed back.
Yeah, and I know that Suicide Squad was, you know, it was heavily reshot, and there was a lot of, like, I'm sure a lot of it was under studio control rather than David Ayer's control, but still, like, why is he back for this? Why, you know, like, Suicide Squad was bad. Why do we need more of that?
Yeah, it's interesting that they're choosing to do another villains movie, considering... Like you said, Suicide Squad. That didn't work out so great.
Yeah, I mean, it made money. It definitely made money, but, like, critical consensus was, like, across the board terrible, and I feel like even, like, most people I've talked to did not like it, you know?
Yeah.
In addition to the Gotham City Sirens movie, which seems to be full steam ahead, they're also still developing a Suicide Squad sequel and a spinoff about Will Smith's Deadshot. They're going all in on the Suicide Squad-iverse inside the Snyderverse. It's like it's like a mini pocket of that universe.
That's comic booky as we can get.
And Gotham City Sirens seems to be the one that has the most headway. I know Margot Robbie was talking about doing a Harley Quinn spinoff, so I guess this is kind of taking the form of that.
That could be that, yeah.
But I don't know that much about Gotham City Sirens, the comic. I know that it involves Poison Ivy and Catwoman. And a couple other female DC villains. It just
sure.
It just seems.
I guess
it seems to me like we should wait until like Justice League's already underway. We should wait and see how that shakes out before going forward with any like ridiculous projects.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I said, like even their heroes are villains. Like we talked, 2016 was so long that Batman vs Superman came out this year. Like, that happened this year.
Yeah.
But even that, like, we need hope and heroism, and it looks like Wonder Woman may be that movie. At least from the trailers, it looks like it may have a glimmer of hope in the story somewhere. Right. So I feel like we need to like get those movies out first before we go back to this all villains team story.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, all female characters, all female cast. That's good. That's a good start. That's good starting point.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, that's awesome. But hopefully, they can make a good movie with it.
Yeah, because the thing is, Harley Quinn was the only female character in Suicide Squad as far... no, there's a couple. But Harley Quinn was the only, like, major one. The rest of them were very, like, underwritten. One was the Enchantress, who was terrible. And then there was Katana, who had, like, two lines. But Harley Quinn was not, like, well-treated as a female character in Suicide Squad, if we recall, right? Like, she was grossly over-sexualized. Her relationship, her abusive relationship with the Joker was glorified. I don't have that much faith in a David Ayer-directed Gotham City Sirens movie. I would love to be proven wrong on this.
Yeah, exactly.
Much as I would like to be proven wrong about any upcoming DC projects. I do look forward to Wonder Woman. I think it looks cool. And I'm really holding out hope for Aquaman because that's James Wan. You know, that's my man.
That's our boy, yeah.
That's my boy. But otherwise, I'm very much on the fence about any future DC projects. I mean, I was burned twice this year by DC with Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad. And I don't know how much more burns I can take. I don't know how much more I can dig it. But that is Gotham City Sirens. Let's get into some casting news. Here's some big stuff happening here. Sonica Martin Green, who plays Sasha on The Walking Dead, has been cast as the lead of Star Trek Discovery.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. You know, I'm a big fan of that. She's really good on The Walking Dead. She plays Sasha. I assume this means that she will be killed off on that show at some point in the near future.
I mean... I guess you're not wrong.
As far as The Walking Dead goes, we've been on record complaining about The Walking Dead quite a bit.
Yep.
If she does get killed off in The Walking Dead, I would say it's probably best for her, because The Walking Dead has been pretty rough this season.
Yeah, I mean, that leaves, like, what, like, three good characters left, maybe?
That's true.
I mean, I hammered through, like, five seasons of The Walking Dead, and I've just been, like, every 2 weeks I watch another episode of season six at this point. Like, I'm just over it. So bad.
Yeah, I mean, I remember season five liking season five, and then season six, there's bad stuff in there. There's good stuff in there too.
It's the same thing as every other season.
That's the thing.
It's like, hey, this is a good episode, and then six episodes later, there's another good episode.
Yeah, it's getting really hard to justify myself continuing to watch The Walking Dead, which is a bummer. It's a bummer. I still haven't watched the mid-season finale, which aired almost 2 weeks ago now. And you know what the worst thing about the season of The Walking Dead is? I didn't mean to get on a Walking Dead rant, but here we are.
But like we say, whenever we have the chance, we're going to do it.
The worst part about the season of The Walking Dead is that, A, it's basically retreading, like, familiar ground. Like, Negan is basically the governor, just a little more sadistic. And, like, I can deal with that. Like, Jeffrey Dean Morgan is doing a great job as Negan. His performance is fantastic. It's charismatic. And, like, he carries the show a lot of the time. But the show has been very boring this season. And also, every episode is 90 minutes long.
What?
Almost every episode this season has been longer than 60 minutes. And most of the time, they're close to 90 minutes. And it's horrible.
If there's anything the show that has pacing issues needs,
it's more pacing issues.
Yeah.
So it's been rough. It's been a rough go of it for Walking Dead fans, or at least for me. But even like I've heard their ratings have been declining this season. I think a lot of fans actually did. Like, people have always said, like, they're going to ditch The Walking Dead after this character dies or this character dies. I feel like this time around, they might have actually done it. people might have actually ditched the show. And the ratings are still good. Like, they're still, like, among the highest rated on TV, but it's much lower than it has been in the past. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens with The Walking Dead, but its future
may... So the Star Trek thing.
Yeah, the Star Trek thing. Star Trek Discovery. Now, this show was originally being developed by Brian Fuller, who has since stepped down. And it seems like he actually won't have any involvement with the show at this point. That said, Sonic Martin Green. Great, great casting choice.
Yeah, and I think it's cool that we're getting a woman of color as the... protagonist, like the main character,
the lead of the show,
of a Star Trek. You know, if there's any show that should have happened immediately, it's Star Trek.
Yes.
So I'm glad to see at least they're leading the charge on that, on diversity in TV and stuff.
Absolutely.
So
that's, Yeah, that's very cool. And then I did want to mention this other casting bit, that Walton Goggins, one of my favorite actors working today, has been cast as the villain in the Tomb Raider reboot, and I am very excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, he, like we always talk about him as being somebody that we want in everything. Right. So this is exciting.
Yeah, I'm very excited to just see him chewing scenery, doing his Boyd Crowder from Justified thing, and crushing it. Also, side note, he's fantastic on Vice Principals, if you need more incentive to watch that show.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, I was just flipping past HBO, and I caught the last 20 minutes of Hateful Eight, and it was just so joyous to watch Walton Goggins in that again.
Yes, I've watched Hateful Eight probably like 4 or 5 times this year. Like, and it's a long movie. I've made time to watch it quite a few times. It's just so good. And Walton Goggins is so good in it.
Yeah.
It's great. But anyway, yeah. So I did want to mention that. That's pretty cool. And then finally, I did want to mention that the Golden Globe nominations came out last week. And the Golden Globes are traditionally terrible. But...
sometimes we get to see drunken acceptance speeches. So that's fun.
Yeah, that's the thing. The Golden Globes are like... I think in the right hands, they are often the most fun award show to watch because all the people who are nominated for it's like a dinner and it's like a banquet, and so people are getting trashed and hammered, and like it's a much looser vibe than the Oscars or the Emmys or something like that. But the actual awards of the Golden Globes are a joke. They're ridiculous. Every year, there's at least one Golden Globe nomination that makes you go like, huh, like what?
Right.
And the reason for that is because it's a much smaller group of people. Who make up the Academy of the Golden Globes, the HFPCA or whatever it is.
Isn't that the Humane? That's like the Humane Society.
Okay, I mixed that up. Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the HFPA.
Sarah McLachlan hosts every year.
But it's an academy of like 70 different people, foreign journalists. And what ends up happening is that studios will send their stars and like hang out, like send all sorts of gift baskets and like party with all these journalists and stuff to like schmooze them over so that their movies get nominated for awards. And so that's when you get a situation like in 2010, The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie was nominated for several Golden Globes. Which is a movie that has like a 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like it was largely considered terrible. And so this year, the nominees aren't that bad this year. However, there are a few that are like they kind of make you question it. But so for Best Drama, you got Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. And I think those are all solid choices, you know?
Right.
Especially, I mean, Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight are going to be like huge at the Oscars this year. It's going to be... Like, for Best Picture at the Oscars, it's basically down to... I think it's going to be down to Manchester by the Sea, Moonlight, and La La Land. Those are, like, the three big contenders, I think. And so those are all solid choices. Then you get to the Best Comedy or Musical category, which is a ridiculous category, because comedies and musicals are not interchangeable.
Nope.
And so there you get some solid... You get some solid nominees. You get 20th Century Women, which I've heard is great. You get La La Land, obviously. You get Sing Street. Which is fantastic. I love Sing Street. Then there's Florence Foster Jenkins, which is the movie that Meryl Streep starred in about like the failed opera singer in August. Came out in like August, and I've heard it was good. I don't know if it's like best comedy musical good, but I've heard.
But why not?
I've heard it's solid. And then you have Deadpool, which is insane. And on the one hand, like, I liked Deadpool. I thought it was like fun. I don't think I would nominate it in this category. I like that a movie like Deadpool that can get nominated in this category.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, it's Deadpool, you know? Like, there had to be a more deserving nominee
right
for this category that didn't make the cut. And so that's a little weird. And then those are all the best movies nominated for Best Picture in the two different categories. And then also in the Best Actor in a Comedy category, Ryan Reynolds is nominated for Deadpool.
Sure.
And Jonah Hill is nominated for War Dogs. the Todd Phillips movie that came and went August or September that I've heard it was basically like Wolf of Wall Street but bad. Like,
yeah.
He was nominated for that, which is crazy. That's weird. And then you have the best TV categories. Best TV drama, you got The Crown, which is on Netflix, I think. It's a Netflix show. Game of Thrones, Stranger Things, This Is Us, and Westworld. And I'm amazed that Westworld is nominated because that show ended like a week ago.
Yeah, like, that ended just before the nominations were announced.
Yeah, so they must have submitted these nominations beforehand, I would imagine.
Yeah, they must have just banked on it being really good.
Yeah, like probably like four episodes in, they were like, all right, I think this will turn out fine. I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
And so that's a little weird. And also This Is Us, which also just started this year. The Golden Globes have like a habit of rewarding new shows. And that's kind of their thing. And that's actually been helpful to shows that haven't gotten that much attention in their first season, the struggle in the ratings. For example, Brooklyn Nine-Nine won Best Comedy in its first season at the Golden Globes. And it's kind of encouraged Fox to renew the show for a second season and that kind of thing. So that in that respect, that's pretty cool. This Is Us is a new show on NBC, which I've heard is like solid. Again, I don't know if it's best TV drama worthy, but like... Solid.
But sure, I guess.
And then for best TV comedy, you've got Atlanta, which is fucking awesome. Blackish. Mozart in the Jungle, which I think won last year.
I think so.
Transparent and Veep. Solid picks for the comedy thing. I don't have too many complaints about that. That's I mean, Atlanta and Veep are the only ones I really watch, and those ones are fantastic. And I've heard Transparent's very good. I actually watched the first few episodes of Transparent and liked it and never kept going. But one day.
One day, Mike.
One day.
After you finish 9,000 other shows.
Yeah, exactly. I just finished Twin Peaks, by the way. I'll throw that out there.
Good job. I'm so proud of you.
Before we even get into our discussions, I finished Twin Peaks. It's very good.
Just in. Man says Twin Peaks is good. Breaking news.
I've not watched Firewalk with Me yet, but I got it in the mail the other day, so I'm very excited to watch that. But anyway, yeah, so the Golden Globes are going to be airing on, I think, January 8th, hosted by Jimmy Fallon. So that's going to be excruciating, but... Honestly, I like Jimmy Fallon, or at least I did before he was on The Tonight Show. I feel like once he hit The Tonight Show, I feel like it became so much more about, like, pandering to, like, 90s nostalgia and, like...
Correct.
It came more about games than it was about like jokes and stuff. And
yeah,
you know, when he was on Late Night, like I thought he was fun. Like I enjoyed his antics.
Right.
And you know, before I remember he hosted the Emmys a while ago, like years ago, and it was one of the best Emmys ever.
I think I remember that. Yeah.
He like did a whole like he had a whole like musical opening set to Born to Run with with some of the cast of Glee and like Tina Fey and Joel McHale, and like he came out on stage and like Randy Jackson was like Clarence Clemens. It was fucking awesome.
Right. I remember that.
So that was like one of the best Emmys ever. So maybe he can tap into that for this Golden Globes, but we'll see what happens.
Probably not, though.
Probably not. It's current Jimmy Fallon. He's going to be oddly off kilter, tussling Trump's hair and
normalizing Nazism. You know,
how he does. Anyway, that about wraps it up for film news. Let's move on into our discussion. What's this? These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time for our discussions on a film bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today I have to discuss one of Netflix's 18 million new shows they put out.
Yeah, literally, like, in the past week, I feel like I've read about, like, six different Netflix shows that just premiered. I know there's this one called The OA with, like, Britt Marling, like, the same
team.
That's, like, another
that's the new Stranger Things, apparently.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to catch on like Stranger Things did, but...
probably not. But, yeah, so this one is called The White Rabbit Project, and it is the build team from Mythbusters. That's Carrie Byron, Tori Belleci, and Grant Imahara. You know, Mythbusters, I think, just ended this year. This past season was their final season.
It was recent, yes.
So they took these guys and they gave them their own Netflix show. And it's kind of the same thing as Mythbusters. It's a little less sciencey. You know, that was always the thing with Mythbusters. They would get whatever myth, they would recreate the science experiment and would determine whether or not the myth was true. But for White Rabbit Project, it's much more about just concepts. Like, the first episode is superpowers, and it's not about, you know, are superpowers real? It's what would you have to do with today's technology to get the superpower kind of thing.
Okay.
So, like, one of the things is they want to make a freeze ray, so they build a tank with liquid nitrogen and, like, all these, you know, it's just silly build things. If you're looking for more of the kind of science-y experiment, prove this thing is real of Mythbusters, it's not about that so much. It's more about just kind of see what we can make in proof of concept stuff.
Yeah.
So in that regard, it's got a different tone than what Mythbusters had, which is, you know, that was kind of, for me at least, my favorite part of Mythbusters. But this one is still a fun time. These three guys have an amazing chemistry together. So it is fun to watch them just build crazy stuff. Like, how do you build a freeze ray? And they just go for it. And, you know what I mean?
Right.
So there's 10 episodes out. So hopefully it would be cool to see what they do if they get a second season. I know, I think Carrie Byron did an AMA on Reddit where they, because these episodes also feature a lot of reenactment because they're kind of telling a story.
Yeah.
Like one of them is Prison Breaks. So they also, you know, recreate them. And it's, they also did those kind of things on Mythbusters also. But this one, they go, they kind of take up a larger chunk of their, of the episodes.
Okay.
So that she, somebody asked her about that in their AMA, and she said that if they get a season two, they'd like to include more of the sciencey stuff. They want to try to get back to that Mythbusters feel. So hopefully it has, you know, it has enough legs to get a second season, because I think that'd be fun. And always, more Mythbusters stuff is always cool. So
yeah, very
I think
cool.
People should check it out.
All right. So that's The White Rabbit Project. It's available on Netflix, right? It's the new Netflix original show, one of 17.
Yes.
And speaking of 17, my first discussion today is a movie called The Edge of 17.
Ooh, Captain Segway strikes again.
And this is the new coming-of-age comedy-drama starring Hailee Steinfeld in the lead role. And it's the directorial debut of Kelly Freeman Craig. It also stars Woody Harrelson, Kira Sedgwick, and Blake Jenner from Everybody Wants Some. And I am a sucker for high school movies. Just, it's just a thing. I really like them in general. And this one really, really works. You know, it's very funny. It's very insightful. Hailee Steinfeld is terrific. I haven't seen her in anything since True Grit.
Yeah.
So to me, she was like this 14-year-old kid. Or in my mind, she's like this 12-year-old like thing. And apparently she's like a pop star now. She has like...
Maybe.
Like, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and that she was like, have you heard the new Hailee Steinfeld song? It's great. And I was like, Hailee Steinfeld sings songs? Like, what?
She's matured in age? No.
And apparently it's a song about masturbating. So like, she's really actually like...
Good
Jordan H. And yes, this feels like a definitive high school movie to me, like for the current generation of kids. Like it feels like the definitive millennial high school movie in certain ways, like for the younger age of millennials, I guess. I feel like the millennial gap is so huge. Like there has to be like...
It's because the olds run the world. So anyone who's not old is a millennial now.
Basically. Stupid olds.
God damn.
But this, like, for kids who are, like, 16, 17 now, I feel like this is, like, a definitive high school movie for this period of time, if more people end up seeing it. I don't think it did that well in theaters.
I think it's R-rated also, right?
I believe it is, yeah.
Yeah. That was just an interesting thing. I remember seeing the trailer for it. Not to cut you off, sorry.
Right. No.
But it was like, this is a high school movie and it's R-rated? This is, like, awesome. Could be, like, it seems like a bold concept for what most movies are now.
Yeah.
Do that.
Yeah, but it has gotten tremendous reviews, and I think it will probably be a bigger hit once it hits video on demand and DVD and stuff like that. For example, like, to compare to another, like, pretty big high school movie from recent years, like The Person Being a Wallflower, I think this is much better than The Person Being a Wallflower. And that's... I liked The Person Being a Wallflower. I thought it was fun. I liked it. But this feels like much more honed in and specific on a certain experience. And I really responded to it. I thought it was very good. So that's The Edge of 17. And the other movie I wanted to talk about is a movie called Wiener.
Oh, man. We clearly have not aged or matured.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. And this is not a documentary about wieners. This is a documentary directed by Josh Krugman and Elise Steinberg about Anthony Weiner, and specifically his run for mayor of New York City in 2013. And so it's like a fly-on-the-wall documentary just kind of detailing his entire campaign. And this was a couple of years after his sexting scandal forced him to resign from Congress. And right before the second sexting scandal happened. This is a great documentary. You know, I had heard very good things about this going in, so that's why I checked it out. But it's really interesting because it's a portrait of a guy who would have had a bright political career. Like he was like potentially on track to like become president one day. Like if you watch like the stuff at the beginning of this movie, like he was incredible. If not for this one thing that he keeps fucking up.
if he could just keep his wiener in his pants.
Yep. seeing footage of that early congressional career, like this is a guy who was like respected and like was making it seemed like he was actually making a difference instead of, you know, a laughing stock.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. He was a pretty big hope, I remember, for the new Democratic Party, at least in New York.
Yeah.
And then he was like, hey, look at my dick, everyone.
Yeah, I'd say surprisingly candid look behind the curtain, you know, at what goes on in the private lives of public figures. There's like bits, like it's a fly on the wall documentary, and occasionally, like, the documentarians will actually speak and, like, talk to Anthony Weiner. And he's, like, sarcastic and he's kind of funny, like, at points. And you see, like, his inner life and, like, he kind of just paints him as a guy who's trying to do good, but he keeps screwing up at every turn. Like, he keeps self-sabotaging himself, and it's, like, insane to watch. And it's so frustrating to watch it, especially in light of recent events, because Anthony Weiner was part of the second – email leak or whatever with Hillary Clinton's thing where the FBI was like investigating. So it's potentially because of him that Nazis are running the country, but
man, okay, hold on, never mind.
What were you gonna say?
I would say this is a highly politicized episode, but it's kind of relevant for Star Wars.
It is kind of relevant for Rogue One. I think we're gonna touch upon it in the Rogue One review, so we might as well get it out there now. So anyway, Weiner is I really recommend it. It's available on Showtime right now, actually. I know it premiered at Sundance a while, like, back in January, and I think it ended up being distributed through Showtime. Or I think it played in theaters, but I think Showtime picked up the rights for it. So it's available on demand on Showtime. It's a very good, really interesting documentary. I highly recommend people check it out. But that is it for my discussions, Mike. So let's move on into our highly politicized discussion of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Our rebellion is all that remains to push back the Empire. You think you might be able to help us?
When was the last time you were in contact with your father?
What is this? It appears he is critical to the development of a super weapon.
If my father built this thing, we need to find him.
All right. How many do I need?
They are requesting a call sign.
It's, Rogue. Rogue One.
The power that we are dealing with here is immeasurable.
If the Empire has this kind of power, what chance do we have?
We have hope. Rebellions are built on hope.
All right, that was from the trailer for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, directed by Gareth Edwards and written by Chris Weitz and Tony Gilroy. The movie stars Felicity Jones, Diego Luna, Ben Mendelsohn, Donnie Yen, Mads Mikkelsen, Alan Tudyk, Riz Ahmed, Jian Wen, and Forrest Whitaker. And the IMDb plot synopsis reads like this. It's barely a sentence. The Rebel Alliance makes a risky move to steal the plans for the Death Star, setting up the epic saga to follow.
Sure.
It's not wrong. It's not wrong. It can essentially be, like, that IMDb plot synopsis could just be the opening crawl of A New Hope. the first sentence in the opening crawl of A New Hope.
You're not wrong. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, so we've talked in the past, Mike, about our fondness for the little-known science fiction series called Star Wars.
Yes, the space movie that no one's heard of.
Right. We've even dedicated the entire episode to the franchise for our Force Awakens review. We reviewed Force Awakens. We also talked about our history with Star Wars, and we talked about what we were hoping out of Star Wars and stuff like that. So we don't really need to get into whether we like Star Wars or not, because obviously we do.
Yeah.
Right. But I think Rogue One could be like the biggest indicator for the future of the franchise, right? Like, you know, there's the main trilogy films. But this is the first Star Wars spinoff, which will primarily focusing on characters that we have not seen in previous films. And if that works, it sets a precedent for future spinoff films to follow, which I am intrigued by, certainly. Because the other spinoff film that's in the works right now is the Han Solo movie, and that's obviously a pre-existing character.
Yeah.
So I would rather this be the model to go forward. You know, I would rather new characters and new adventures to be told through this prism of Star Wars, rather than seeing younger versions of characters I already know.
Yeah, that is definitely a thing. When I came out of Rogue One, I had the same thought was, oh, man, I'm nervous for the young Han Solo movie now because it's going to be the thing we already know. And this is something – Rogue One was so new or so outside the realm of what we had seen in the other movies that it kind of makes me a little apprehensive about the young Han Solo movie.
I mean, I think I think Han Solo will be good. Because
I have full faith.
Phil Lord and Chris Miller making it, they're the best. But – you know, at the same time, like, I don't need a young Han Solo movie, whereas this feels like it could be a really interesting story. So, I mean, coming out of Rogue One, man, what did you think? What was your overall thoughts on Rogue One?
See, the thing, I went into Rogue One wanting pretty much one thing, and that was a down and dirty war movie set in the Star Wars universe. And when I walked out, I was able to check that box. So it delivered on the things that I wanted. I had a crazy amount of fun with this whole story. It was really interesting to be able to see brand new things in the Star Wars universe with stuff we didn't know about that we weren't. I mean, we are beholden to, you know, the universe as a whole, but we get to learn new characters. We meet new stuff. We learn. We're given backstory to some things. It fleshes out. It enriches the original trilogy. And it's really cool to see a 2-hour movie that doesn't have to expand and set up and leave plot lines to be picked up for other movies.
Because they're already being picked up in other movies.
Yeah, they're already done. That's what we're able to, you know, in this the world of franchise building for every movie, we don't have to do that. I mean, we kind of do a little bit in this one because it has to connect to the other movie that's already made, but we don't have to leave open-ended questions and some character, their eyes open at the end of the movie or whatever, you know, like somebody we thought was dead's not dead. Like, right. So I had a ton of fun, and those were my immediate thoughts when I came out.
Cool. Yeah, I also, I very much enjoyed Rogue One. I feel like I enjoyed the movie a lot. I had a lot of problems with it, too.
Sure.
But at the same time, I really enjoyed it. There are aspects of Rogue One that are, to my mind, phenomenal. You know, the battle sequences in particular. There are roughly, like, I would say three, like, big action set pieces in the movie, right? There's the escape sequence on Jedha. There's the sequence at the Imperial base. And then there's the big climactic battle at Scarif. And they all work like gangbusters. Like, they're fucking awesome.
Yeah.
The action is intense. It's inventive. It makes you feel the cost of war, which is something that Star Wars doesn't really do for something that has war in the title, you know?
Right.
And I'm also a big fan of this movie on a thematic level. I think it works very well. I think, you know, Star Wars to this point has been about, like, chosen heroes and villains, like, you know, the people who are fated to, you know, save the galaxy and that kind of thing.
Right.
While Rogue One is much more interested in the average person who still decides to fight the fight anyway. There's no better time for that than in the age of a President Trump to watch an incredibly diverse band of individuals work to take down a tyrannical dictator.
Yeah, exactly. There's no better time than to hear the sentence "rebellions are founded on hope," than today when the Electoral College is voting.
Yeah, that's true. And I think all the new characters that are introduced are very cool. Though I never felt like we got to know any of them in the way that we got to know Rey, Finn, and Kylo Ren in The Force Awakens. You know,
sure.
I feel like we got a lot more out of those characters in that movie than we did in this movie. That said, Donnie Yen and Jiang Wen were the highlight for me. They were unique.
Absolutely.
And Donnie Yen got to bust out some of his martial arts skills a few times, and it was fucking awesome.
Yeah, I definitely – that's the big complaint I've been seeing online is that a lot of these characters are flat. We don't really learn anything about them, and the things we do learn were told instead of shown. You know, I see the comparison a lot with, you know, Han Solo in A New Hope. We're shown that he is only in it for himself, and he eventually converts to be a hero of the rebellion and all this stuff. Meanwhile, for Donnie Yen's character – Diego Luna turns to Jin, or Cassian turns to Jin and is like, these guys were temple guards, and we just move on. But I think he even says something along the lines of, we don't have time to make new friends. Like, we got this 2-hour tight war movie story we got to tell.
Right.
I can't afford, I guess, to take the time to learn their history as temple guards.
That's fair. I mean, I think we get, like, just enough from these characters.
Yeah.
To make us care about them, and that works. But at the same time, like, you know, I feel like I got to know Rey, Finn, and Kylo Ren a lot better. Not so much Poe Dameron, because he disappears for half the movie. But, but you know, Oscar Isaac was a blast to watch anyway. I feel like, you know, this is a great ensemble, and I kind of wish some of them had more to do. But they all do kind of get their moment, and they all kind of shine in certain parts of the movie, and that works very well.
Yeah, I think that they're also – all those other characters are given the benefit – Rey, Finn – and Poe, soon to be, I guess.
Yeah.
Are given the benefit of having three movies length. Or, you know, eventually they're going to have a full arc that takes place over three movies.
Right.
The cast of Rogue One gets one movie that we all kind of knew what the end of it was going to be.
Right.
So they don't have as much time, I guess, is what I'm saying. So I'm trying to rationalize why the characters are come off as kind of flat.
Right.
But I think, like you said, we're given enough for what the purpose of the movie is.
Yeah, I don't think they're flat. I just think we're given, like, just enough. Yeah. Also, Alan Tudyk as K2SO, I want to throw that out there, is pretty great as well.
Oh, yeah.
He offers a lot of the film's comic relief. I don't understand why droids are programmed to be snarky in the Star Wars universe, because it seems like every droid is sarcastic.
I don't know why, but I'm glad they are. at least K2, I love the amount of salt that he is made out of.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, but I would say that the opening scene of this movie is incredibly strong. It's really, really good, and we'll talk about specifics and spoilers. But I did think the movie was a little messy for its first like half hour or so.
Yeah,
you know, it's jumping into so many different stories and locations so quickly.
I think maybe in the first act of this movie, we visit more planets than we ever do in the whole six other or seven episodes so far.
Yeah.
But that said, it is messy and it is a breakneck pace, but I think it works in that we're finally shown a literal universe. Like, Star Wars takes place in like galaxies. We're talking about galaxies. We're finally not dealing with Tatooine. We're finally not dealing with the Skywalkers. We're seeing the same places and people in every episode so far. And we finally get to see more of that, which is what these expanded universe movies, I hope, do a lot more of.
I agree with that. I think there is an attempt to make the universe feel a lot bigger than it has in the past. But at the same time, there are things in this movie that make the universe feel smaller to me, specifically like fan servicey bits, which I will talk about in spoilers. And so I think there is like a push and pull there. The opening scene, though, is incredibly strong. It's so good. But for that first half hour, we're not really given a chance to process a lot of the stuff that's happening because we're just jumping to the next thing really quick.
I would definitely agree with that.
And I will talk about who this is in spoilers. There is one character from the original trilogy that is recreated entirely through CGI. It is an actor playing him, but it's, you know, his voice is, I think his voice is modulated and it's entirely, his face is entirely modified to look like the original actor.
Right.
And this has become a very divisive point among a lot of fans. I'm curious to know where you stand on this, because I was not really a fan of this. I didn't care for it.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was kind of cool that it happened. Like I said, when you introduced the beginning, it's like I admit that it is a impressive technological feat that they are able to do that now.
Yeah.
That said, it does, like you said, it is an uncanny valley, weird,
very much
distracting, pulls me out of the movie thing. So that's where I land on that.
Yeah. So yeah, it, to me, it was a distraction. Like I could not pay attention to any scene that character was in. Because you know, I was just focused on like, wow, like, why is this? Like, what is happening? Like, it's just such a weird thing to see. And it would be just kind of unnecessary. Like, the character could have easily been written out and replaced with something else. I think very little could change. And it's also, I think, a little bit disrespectful to the original actor. And we'll get to why that is in a little bit. But I don't think this is as good a movie as overall as The Force Awakens. But I do think that there are individual elements of this movie that are much better than The Force Awakens. The climax, specifically, is tremendous. It's one of the best climaxes in any Star Wars movie, I think. It's great.
Yeah, I'm not sure where it ranks. I know a lot of people were saying it's better than Empire Strikes Back.
That's insane. I would not put it as high as any of the original trilogy movies, but it's better than the prequels, for sure. And
they got that going.
You know, I would put it about on par with Force Awakens. Because the weird thing is, I think it does well the things that Force Awakens does not do well, but the things that Force Awakens does well, I don't think this movie does as well. So it's kind of like, you know, I don't know. It's a little uneven in that regard, but but yeah, that climax though is fantastic. And this movie, I feel like this movie had the perfect shot to end the movie on, and then it just kept going for a few minutes. And the thing is, the stuff that it kept doing, it was like good. I liked it.
Yeah.
But there was just such a perfect shot to end it on that would have been like this fantastic thing. And we'll talk about that in spoilers, obviously. We'll get to spoilers pretty soon, I think.
Yeah.
I also don't think this is as good as Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, which came out 2 years ago, which was this director's previous film. That is, to my mind, one of the best blockbusters in recent years. That's the one that got him the job for this one.
Right.
And I defended this movie a lot during its reshoots. You know, there was a whole controversy. about the reshoots for this movie. And I defended it a lot, saying, you know what, all movies have reshoots, it's fine, it's whatever. But I do think the final product does feel like it's a lighter movie than Edwards might have originally set out to make. And it's still darker than Star Wars usually gets. You know, it's still grittier and more intense than Star Wars usually gets. But it's shot with this tremendous eye for scale. I think it's probably like Edwards' greatest strength. It's like scale in Godzilla and in this movie. It's like, you know, the sight of the Death Star is it like dominating over the screen. Oh, you know, there's the one shot of the Death Star kind of rising up as if it's like the moon or something, or the sun of this planet as it's about to destroy it, and it's insane. Yeah,
it eclipses the sun.
Yeah, it's incredible to see. So like, that's really cool. But at the end of the day, like, I do feel like Disney might have modified it a little bit to fit more in line with the tone of Star Wars, quote unquote, which is a little bit of a bummer. You know, I'm a fan of uncompromised visions. To me, Star Wars, you know, regardless of what you say about the prequels, they are like wholeheartedly George Lucas, like in every respect.
Yeah.
You know, and to my mind, the prequels, like, I love Force Awakens and I like Rogue One a lot, but the prequels I think have much better world building than either of these movies. Like, they, you know, the worlds that are created in the prequels are really interesting. You know, Kamino and Mustafar and Naboo and all these different planets and stuff, they're very imaginative and very interesting. Whereas I remember Force Awakens, one of the big complaints about the movie is that all the planets are rehashes of planets that we've seen before.
Right.
You know, and in Rogue One, I feel like there are a lot of different planets that we visit, but we don't get enough of them to really get a sense of what that planet is like.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to a lot of the pacing stuff we talked about, where, like, we get one scene, whoosh, we're on another planet, woo, we don't really get to expand. We do get to spend a lot of time on Jedha, at least, which I thought was really cool. That's one of my favorite sequences.
Yeah, the Jedha stuff is great. I liked Jedha a lot, and that's, it almost reminded me of, like, Aladdin's village in Aladdin, like,
yeah,
which is what I kind of liked about it. Like, it seemed like something, it was, like, almost like Tatooine, but it felt like its own thing, unlike Jakku on Force Awakens.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was cool. I will say there's a lot of fan service in this movie that is, like, eye-rollingly bad, I think. There's some good stuff. There is some good fan service in this movie that I think is a lot more subtle and more interesting and a better shout-out to fans. But I think the fan service in this movie, like, it kind of, like, stops it dead for me. And I'll mention some of that in spoilers. But I think we should get into spoilers. But I will say I did really enjoy Rogue One, even if it sounds like I'm complaining about it a lot.
yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, it's a new Star Wars, and the I may have problems with it throughout, but it really comes alive during those battle scenes. Like, to me, and absolutely. Those battle scenes make up the bulk of the movie.
And I think its strengths definitely outweigh its weaknesses. Like we said, it does have some maybe character development issues. It has some pacing issues. It has some cheesy wink wink fan service stuff. But I think throughout, it's a lot of fun. And it's what I wanted. It's the down and dirty war movie in Star Wars, so yeah. I'm there.
It's perfect. All right, so we got a lot to talk about in spoilers, Mike, so let's do that now. Let's move on to spoilers for Rogue One, starting right now.
Stop it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, starting right now. I do want to give this movie credit. It is kind of insane in today's, like, modern blockbuster landscape to make a movie in which every main character dies at the end.
Yeah.
And that's something that I felt like almost had to happen. Like, even going in, I was like, there's no way that these characters can live, right? Like,
because then why aren't they in the rest of the movies?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's sort of a necessary choice since none of these characters are around for A New Hope. Right. But it's ballsy and it's risky, and I like that. And better yet, each death is affecting in its own way. Like, each character gets their moments to be a hero. And while I would have liked to see more from them throughout the movie, it really did feel like they each played a crucial role in the climax of the movie. And for that, I really liked it. I do think the movie, like I was talking about, the perfect shot that it could have ended on before, it should have ended with the shot of Jin and Cassian embracing as the Death Star destroyed the town in Scarif that they were in.
Right.
You know, that cut to white, it was just so good. It was the end of Melancholia, and it was awesome. Like, like, you know, that big explosion with Jin and Cassian embracing, cut to white, followed by the credits. That would have been bold as fuck.
It would have been,
you know. And instead, the movie continues, so it can tie into A New Hope. And here's the thing: most of that is good, right?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite sequences in the film.
That definitely is what I got the impression of too. You got Darth Vader being a badass, right?
Yeah.
You have rebels fearing for their lives. I think the key scene of the movie to me is actually in this moment, in which one rebel, knowing he's about to die, is able to get the Death Star plans through the door and pass it on to the next guy who is able to run to Leia. You know, this is an anonymous guy whose one action impacted everything that happens next. And that's the entire point of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, it really hammers home the whole theme. It's just this relay race down a hallway as people are just getting slaughtered, and it's amazing. It's terrifying. It's like, you know, there's 3 minutes left in the movie or whatever at this point. And I still am excited and scared and nervous about what's happening.
Right. Yes, so that's great. And then the plans get brought to Leia, who is also recreated through CGI. This is different than the other character I was talking about before, who says the plans represent hope, and they speed off to go start the original movie.
Yeah, which, to be fair, I did read an article about how that makes the beginning of A New Hope hilarious, because Vader gets to stand there and watch Leia's ship leave.
Right.
Then New Hope starts, and they catch up and board the ship, and Leia's like, no, this is a diplomatic envoy.
Right. I actually did see that, too, and then I saw somebody else make the other argument that, well, actually...
This is a hashtag, actually.
Well, but this is what Star Wars nerds do, right? They think up excuses for things in the movie that doesn't make any sense. And so the thinking behind this is that, the Leia's protest that it's a diplomatic mission in the original Star Wars is that, she knows Darth Vader knows it's bullshit, but she's stalling for time so that R2-D2 and C-3PO can escape.
Ooh, interesting.
There's that.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, why not?
So that's an idea. But anyway, the character I was referring to before, who is created entirely throughout CGI, is Grand Moff Tarkin, who was originally played by Peter Cushing, who died in 1994. On the one hand, the CGI is impressive, right? I cannot deny that the CGI is impressive. I can only imagine the months of work that it took to pull that off, right?
Yeah.
But we've talked about this before. CGI humans are so hard to pull off because we know that they're fake. We see them. And I actually know people who watched the movie and didn't notice that it was fake. And for that, it was like, oh, okay. Like, sure.
Good for them, though.
Good for them. Way to suspend disbelief. But, CGI humans are so hard. I think it absolutely falls into Uncanny Valley. I was reminded of the Robert Zemeckis motion capture movies like Polar Express and Beowulf. Yep. I saw somebody refer to him as Grand Moff Tintin, which is...
That's amazing.
Which is pretty perfect. Yeah. And it's almost like I was thinking about the Jeff Goldblum quote from Jurassic Park. You spent so much time wondering whether you could. You didn't stop to think about whether you should. You know, it may be a technically accurate representation of Peter Cushing. It just looks off, and that doesn't even mention the ethical or moral implications of taking a dead actor and just doing a new performance. In this movie, one person I know kind of compared it and said it wasn't all that different from the CGI Paul Walker in Furious 7. I would argue it is, right? Because Walker had filmed most of that movie when he died.
Right.
And his brother acted as a stand-in, and the CGI was only used to fill out things here and there. It's also pretty difficult to spot the CGI except for the tribute at the end. So, but here you're using a computer to do something that is decidedly very human, right? Acting is a human ability that computers do not have. Once computers can act, what are humans? What do we do? Even?
Right.
You know,
I think it also would have been one thing if it was more of a cameo, like Leia at the end. I'm more willing to forgive because it's, 4 seconds or whatever.
Yeah.
But Tarkin plays a pretty huge, substantial role in
this
film. And he's in a lot of it.
Yeah. It wouldn't the Leia thing didn't even bother me much because Carrie Fisher's still alive. So she can sign off on it if she wants to. I know Peter Cushing's estate signed off on this thing, but it's not Cushing himself. Carrie Fisher is still alive, and she's only on screen for a second. Yeah, she's gone before you can even register that as CGI.
Exactly.
If it was used sparingly and shots where he was difficult to see or obscured, when he's first introduced, you see him he's shown from behind and he's reflected in the window, and then eventually he turns around and it's a big reveal, oh, it's Grand Moff Tarkin.
Yeah.
Or is it? and it's weird. I know people who were blown away by that and were super on board. And I was I don't know about this. There was a subplot on BoJack Horseman this past season. BoJack is shooting a movie called Secretariat, and he leaves and goes on a bender and disappears while the filming's going on. And so they finish the movie without him and just CGI his entire performance.
That's amazing.
And I was reminded of that. I was reminded of a Simpsons quote where...
when are you not?
I know. I hate to be that guy because I feel like I'm mentioning Simpsons quotes every episode now.
but they're kind of amazing.
But there's an episode of The Simpsons where Homer becomes the personal assistant of Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger. And he gets in their bad side. And at the end of the movie, at the end of the show, he has them in they're in a courtroom, and he's if it may please the court. And he has this whole big speech about how celebrities deserve to be exploited and stuff like that. And then his ending line is and when you're dead, you'll all be in commercials dancing with vacuum cleaners. And that was the line that ran through my mind at the end of this movie. I was just like, what is this?
Yeah.
You know? So I was not a big fan of CGI Tarkin. I don't think it was necessary. And I think you could have easily written him out. You know, I think it's like one line of dialogue. You know, all Krennic has to be is like, all Krennic has to say is like, man, Tarkin's really on my ass about this.
And, right.
And like that's
and then
it.
We get the whole point.
Yeah. Like you can easily have like Vader fill in Tarkin's role if you want to. You know, because Vader's not in that much of the movie. Tarkin's in more of the movie than Vader is.
Yeah.
And I feel like it should be the opposite, honestly.
Which is a character behind a mask, and it doesn't matter who it is.
Exactly. James Earl Jones doing the voice. Who cares? But yeah, so anyway, let's talk about the fan service-y stuff. Obviously, I think the Tarkin thing falls into fan service.
Yes.
But other stuff I didn't need. There's the encounter with those two guys from the cantina on Jedha. The he doesn't like you guy.
Oh man, I didn't even notice that. Yeah.
What? You didn't notice that?
I didn't put it together. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he was the he doesn't like you guy. I don't like you either guy. Right. Which is like to me that makes the universe feel smaller. You know, it's right. Like these guys are on the cantina in A New Hope, and they just happen to be in Jedha, like yeah. two days beforehand or something. And it also raises the question of how they left Jedha before it exploded.
Right.
Like, yep. Do they live there? Did their home get destroyed? And then they go to the cantina and then get killed by Obi-Wan?
Just two guys trying to drink their feelings away in the cantina.
I know. So that raised some troubling issues for me as well. Also, there's like a C-3PO and R2-D2 cameo that felt extraneous to me. Like, yeah. It's not something I needed. And Anthony Daniels comes back as C-3PO. Even so, just not something I needed. There was fan service that I did like, though. You know, there was more subtle stuff. Like, for example, I don't know if you caught, I didn't even really catch this until after the movie had ended and I read about this online. There is a archive footage from A New Hope showing Gold Leader and Red Leader.
No, I heard about that afterwards, but
So awesome. So like for Gold Leader and Red Leader, it's the same actors who played them in A New Hope.
Right.
And basically they just use like outtakes and deleted scenes from A New Hope to like have them like giving off commands and stuff. Cause all they'd say is like, oh, gold one, go this way. Or like,
right.
Like they're gaining on us or something. They just have like those kind of lines. And you can even see like, Red Leader, I think it's Red Leader. Like his lines are taped to his lap so that so he's like always looking down.
That's amazing.
to kind of like look at what he's supposed to say. And so I thought that was really cool. That was a neat nod to super fans. I was a little on the fence about this, but I decided I do like this, that Galen Erso intentionally built the weak spot in the Death Star, filling a plot hole that has been there for 40 years.
I mean, it's a pretty clever, I guess, clever way to come up with, to fill that plot hole now.
Yeah, I kind of liked that. And then I also liked, there was that gigantic fucking lava castle on Mustafar that Darth Vader lives in, which is like, okay. But...
It just looks like Sauron's tower.
It does look like Sauron's tower, but that is from like old Ralph McQuarrie concept art for The Empire Strikes Back, I think. And so that's cool. Like that's neat, and I think that's, you know, I can get behind Darth Vader living in a giant lava castle. Like, sure, why not?
Sure, why not? Yeah,
it's never been mentioned before, but I think it's interesting, and it seems like that's something that could be like explored in a future Star Wars movie. I could see like Episode 8 having Kylo Ren discover Darth Vader's giant lava castle.
I just want Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead as the two red Imperial guards of Darth Vader.
Of the Darth Vader lava castle.
Yes, that's what I want. But I do have to say though that you know there is the fan service thing. When we were talking about Red Leader and Gold Leader, that like as we're attacking at the Battle of Scarif, we get like the roll call of all the Blue Leader, Gold Leader, Red Leader, right. Which now is that was so exciting. Like that was one of those makes me giddy. Like fuck yeah, it's Star Wars again, man! Like
one of my favorite things though was there was a red five, and red five was Luke's number in A New Hope, and they make a big deal about how he's red five in this movie, and then they make a big deal about how he dies.
Yeah,
and they're like, oh man, I guess we're gonna need a new red five.
Yeah, it feels pretty weird.
I hope somebody can fill this hole. So that was interesting. There's actually even some prequel fan service in here too, with Jimmy Smith returning as Bail Organa and Genevieve O'Reilly returning as Mon Mothma. She played the younger version of Mon Mothma in Revenge of the Sith, and most of her scenes got cut. So she's actually in like the background of a scene in that movie, but she doesn't like actually. Do anything. She's in like deleted scenes, so it's cool they brought her back for this movie. And I do have to wonder though. There was also a young prequel version of Grand Moff Tarkin, and I can't understand why they didn't get that guy.
Where is that guy?
Exactly.
I was very excited when Jimmy Smith steps out of the shadow in the rebel council room or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that was cool. Like, you know, he was one of the cool parts of the prequels, I guess.
Yeah, he was like a fun, like, solid.
Yeah, whatever.
Like, I feel like he didn't do that much in the prequel, as far as I remember.
Yeah. He does get a cool, like, I know a guy kind of line towards the end of this film, which was fun.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to Alderaan. Nothing bad happens there. I'll send Leia out. And,
I was like, ooh, no.
Goo!
But he's like, oh, I forget what he says. I have a friend who helped us a lot in the Clone Wars or something like that.
Right,
talking about Obi-Wan,
right,
which is cool. Like, it's like I was saying earlier, it's beholden to the universe as a whole, but it doesn't have to full on set up other things because they're already set up and happened.
Yeah, so that's something at least. And I do think this movie works really well in very small moments. So one of my favorite things about this movie, it's this very small moment in the movie which involves Riz Ahmed's character Bodhi, who is an Imperial pilot who defected to give information to the rebellion. And early on, we see him getting interrogated by Saw Gerrera, Forrest Whitaker's character. And that character has a breathing apparatus that makes a similar sound as Darth Vader's. And when he uses it, Bodhi gets like a flash of like PTSD across his face. Like, you can see him like wincing, like, oh my God. And it's really quick, but I thought that was like a really effective way to just establish who Bodhi is and like build that character very quickly.
And it also hints at the terror that is Darth Vader.
Yes.
Because the prequels, like, there's such a disproportionate, I can't think of the right word, but in, you know, he's Lord Vader in the original trilogy, and then right. In the prequels, he's upset at sand. Like, like, what his character is and becomes in those, you know, in the prequels versus what he is in the trilogy doesn't really connect.
Yeah.
But we see that. We see his, you know, the sheer menace and power that he has, that Vader has in Rogue One. We get that bridge between the two characters.
Right.
Which is a plus for this movie.
Yes, very, very much. And speaking of Saw Gerrera, Forrest Whitaker's character, what a weird character that was, right? I feel like there should have been more with him there. Like, I'm not quite sure why he just decided to die in Jedha.
Yeah, he says something about something.
He's like, no, I'm not going to run anymore. Goodbye. And
right.
But I liked Forrest Whitaker's performance. Like, it's just this very like off-kilter kind of thing. He's doing like a very odd voice. And I kind of enjoyed that about it. But oh man, that Jedha fight and escape was terrific. Like, Donnie Yen kicking ass, K2SO making some sarcastic quips, Cassian ruthlessly killing one of Saw Gerrera's guys instead of the Imperial guys to destroy some of the Imperials. Everything in that fight stemmed from character moments, and that's what I really dug about it. Like, even though like I said, we're only given like just enough to work with these characters, like, I feel like they build off of that very well.
I feel like Saw Gerrera's character may have been one of the victims of the reshoots, because we see, you know, that's part of the thing that's happened with the marketing and stuff. Show us what the movie kind of was supposed to be or was originally.
Yeah, that first trailer is a lot different than I think what this movie ended up being.
Yeah, we're shown that Jin is all, you know, this is a rebellion, isn't it? I rebel. And in the final cut, we're kind of given the, like, half-assed, I'm not in the rebellion, I'm in this for myself thing until the middle of the movie.
Right.
And, you know, Saw Gerrera in the original trailer is asking Jin, well, you know, what will you do when they come for you? What will you become?
Yeah, what will they break? What will they do when they break you? And it was a great speech in the trailer. And he also looks a lot different in that trailer, too. He does not have the insane hair and crazy eyes and, like, weird. Like, he just looks like Forrest Whitaker.
And we're shown, you know, he has the breathing apparatus in the final cut. You know, he's got the breathing apparatus. He's got metal legs.
Yeah.
Like, so he's literally physically changed because of the Empire and the Rebellion.
Yes.
Adds that more power to that speech he's giving in the trailer. But we don't get that in the movie, and then he just kind of decides to die.
It feels like there definitely should have been more with that character.
Yeah.
In any case, Forrest Whitaker does give a good performance. Ben Mendelsohn is very good as Orson Krennic, especially in that first Inglourious Basterds-esque opening scene.
Yeah.
I really dug that. You know, to depict the villain in this movie as a bureaucrat trying to climb the ranks of the Empire feels incredibly relevant to our modern society. And actually, Disney executive Bob Iger has said that there was controversy controversy among Nazis that a couple of weeks ago, where you know, people like Trump supporters were complaining that there was rumors going around that the reshoots for Rogue One made it explicitly an anti-Trump film. And
sure.
I don't think that was the intention, because I mean, Trump just became president. But yeah. You know, Disney executive Bob Iger went on record and said Rogue One is not a political film. But producer Keith Calder, who didn't produce Rogue One, but he produces several other movies. He produces like The Guest and You're Next, and he's on Twitter. Yeah. He's on Twitter a lot. He put it on Twitter. All films are political films.
And, absolutely, yeah.
And that's true, because like, how you perceive a film depends on what you bring into it. And I would say every Star Wars movie is very political by their nature. I mean, the Empire is modeled after Nazis.
Right.
And if you think your candidate reminds you of the bad guys in Star Wars, that problem isn't Star Wars. The problem is your candidate.
Yeah, I was going to say that it seems like probably, like, almost everything is probably anti-Nazi. So, like... It's kind of easy to just pick a thing and be like, that's anti-Nazi.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, yeah, that is the, you know, the Disney executive's job is to be like, this is not a political statement. But yeah, this is, it's, yeah, it's the Empire, the iron fist of the Empire being fought against by the, like you said, the diverse group, ragtag group, willing to sacrifice everything
right.
to take it down. So yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. And the Darth Vader scenes, again, I mean, I feel like the Darth Vader scenes that kind of come off as kind of fan service-y, they kind of come off as like, well, we got to include Darth Vader in this movie in some capacity, right? I liked his, like, he's only really in two scenes, right? He's in that scene where he's confronting Ben Mendelsohn,
yes.
And he's in that scene at the end where he's slicing up rebels and stuff.
Right.
I liked the slicing up rebels scene. That was great. I think the scene where he's talking to Ben Mendelsohn's Orson Krennic,
and he makes the dopest pun in Star Wars history.
So you're a fan of the pun.
I was all in. I was in.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how I feel about Vader making puns. I don't know.
I mean, for his character, it feels very weird. But that said, like, Star Wars, the original trilogy, is kind of like a very pulpy space western thing anyway. And I wish they kind of – and they lean into it kind of heavy, especially in that scene with the Vader thing. There's
right.
another one that I can't remember where Jin makes like a quip that's like straight out of a Raymond Chandler novel to Cassian. And I can't remember what it is exactly.
Okay.
So I'm in for the pulpy sci-fi.
Sure, like, absolutely.
Stuff.
But I don't
that's
know.
All I that's all I have to say.
I don't know. I feel like I don't see either original trilogy Darth Vader or prequel trilogy Anakin Skywalker ever saying, don't choke on your aspirations.
While force-choking
somebody. I just don't see it happening.
No, that's totally fair.
But, you know, I was like, this scene is, like, it's fun to see Darth Vader again. I did think the suit looked kind of off in that scene. Like, did it look weird to you? Like, it looked kind of fake?
I don't think I noticed that, but to be fair, like, the original suit, like, all the original stuff is so awful.
Well,
like, it looks cool, but it's, like, pinned together.
I mean, here's the thing. The original suit... I feel like this is very much modeled after Darth Vader's original suit. But in the original movie, Lucas used all kinds of like lighting tricks to make it look more intimidating than it was.
Okay.
It didn't seem like they did that here.
Right.
So to me, it kind of looked like a dude like in a Darth Vader costume being like, hey!
You That's
know,
fair.
Like a Halloween
yeah.
costume or something. It was cool to hear, but I mean, still, James Earl Jones, though, is Darth Vader. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I think, if I remember correctly, he's going to be one of those people like Peter Cushing. You know, that once James Earl Jones dies, we're still going to have him as Darth Vader.
Because
he does, he voices the character on one of the cartoons, I think. I don't remember.
He has voiced it on Star Wars Rebels, I know that much.
And if I remember correctly, I think I remember reading somewhere, they had him come in and, like, read the dictionary, basically. And just record, yeah, like, record every, like, insane amount of dialogue so that they have all of it.
Yeah.
So that if, even when he passes away, he will always be Darth Vader, which is another interesting moral question. But
that's interesting. I mean, if that's the case, like that seems like like something James Earl Jones has agreed to.
Right.
So there's yeah. that at least. Okay, so let's talk about the climax of this movie, because I think it makes, like, regardless of any problems that I have with this movie, the climax makes it worth it. Like, it's
yeah.
so good. It's like the last 30-40 minutes of the movie. It's long.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, this huge – it's a space battle for the books. You know, it's one of the best. Seeing the Hammerhead Corvette ram into a Star Destroyer so that it slices through another Star Destroyer
yep.
was everything I wanted out of this movie.
Correct. That's exactly what I needed.
I was watching that and he was like, all right, $11 well spent. You know, that's
–
That was great. And then, you know, there's escalating stakes throughout the thing as it goes on, as characters die one by one. There's terrific wartime ground combat. Donnie Yen using the Force to make his way across the battlefield is incredible. You know, Body getting the message to the rebels before getting hit with a grenade is also great. Cassian surviving his fall to save Jin from Orson Krennic was thrilling and engaging. Orson Krennic being killed by the Death Star, the weapon that he helped create. You know, there's
hashtag analysis.
There's just so much going on, and nothing ever gets lost in the shuffle. Like, it's really well edited and well done. It's a really well executed climax. So even though I do have problems with a lot of the movie as a whole, the climax and other battle scenes and stuff, it really makes it worth it. Like, it's a very good. I think it's a very good Star Wars movie.
Yeah, we're treated to a half-hour Vietnam War movie at the end of Rogue One.
Yes.
And, like, I think even down to the decision for the costuming of the rebels, they're in flak jackets and normal helmets. They're not, you know, in their red and white pilot uniforms like we have only ever seen them mostly.
Right.
To the heavy machine gunner out of the side of the transport ship. Like, I think one of them even has death sticks tucked into his helmet. Like, and they're fighting in a jungle. Like, it's just, it goes straight for the, nope, this is a war movie. And it's just like, it, I don't know. It's one of those things that it feels like a different direction than, it's what we've been talking about this whole time. You know, it's this very unique tone for the Star Wars movies, which makes me super excited for what the other Star Wars stories movies could be.
Yes.
Which is why I said I was a little apprehensive now about Han Solo, only because it's a character we already know, even though I have full faith in that team that's making that movie. So I'm sure it's going to be amazing, but yeah. I want more things like this.
Yeah, the team making that movie is great. The casting is so far very good. Yeah. And I've heard Kathleen Kennedy say that it's going to be more like a heist movie, which for Han Solo is aces. I think that's a great idea.
Perfect. I want like a Smokey and the Bandit like Han Solo movie.
That would be perfect. That would be fantastic. And I feel like when this was first announced, people were saying this was going to be like a heist movie.
Yeah, I think that was the original
thought. But I think it morphed into a war movie over time. So yeah, I did have problems with Rogue One, but at the end of the day, it's a great concept executed pretty well with tremendous battle sequences and a really strong underlying theme. You know, this rebellion built on hope is, I think, a very strong theme we can all live by for the next 4 years.
Could be useful for the next foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And I do want to mention, too, like, I love the fact that we've, like, the technological advances that we've had, like, able to watch a fleet of ships come in out of warp or out of hyperspace.
Yes.
And start this epic battle. And at the same time, they stayed true to what the TIE fighter targeting systems look like. Like, we get all these weird old computer schematic things that are from the original trilogy mixed in with all this high-tech
this new movie stuff
that's happening. Yeah. Which is, it's a lot of, like, it's part of those were some of the really fan-servicey things that I enjoyed a lot.
Yes. I did enjoy a lot of the new stuff, but I think Mike Ryan a while ago was like tweeting about the movie. Like, this is a few months before the movie came out. He was basing this off the trailers, but like the dialogue exchanges in Rogue One, and it was like something blows up. It's like, oh man, that was our last of of that ship. You know?
Yeah, they show the U-Wings, I think, is like a new ship they have on Scarif, but like they're not in any other movies.
Blows, oh man, that was our last U-Wing, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that, I did think that was pretty
cool. But I think they do it. They handle that pretty well, I think, though, because, you know, you look at things like shots of the deck. Okay. So you look at, like, the deck of the Nostromo from Alien versus, like, the ship in Prometheus. And, like, the technology disparity is so backwards because
that's
Prometheus
true.
Technically happens first.
I will say, isn't Prometheus, like, not to talk about Prometheus and Alien, get too much into that, but Alien, the ship in Alien is like a mining ship, right? Whereas the ship in Prometheus is like a science ship, right? Like an exploration ship. So
that sounds right.
It would kind of make sense that the technology would be ahead of
a little
Alien.
A little different.
I'm just throwing that out there. I'm just throwing that out there.
All right. Thanks for the hashtag, actually.
I
like
I don't mean to mansplain Alien to you, but...
But you already did.
Yep.
Yeah, that was just the thing I wanted to throw out there. There's a nice touch that they keep.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Things from the original trilogy.
Yeah. So, yeah. So Rogue One, I didn't love it like other people seem to love it, but I did really, really like it. And I also feel that when I watch it again, I might be more receptive to it. Like, I think I'm going to enjoy it more on a rewatch.
Yeah.
I feel like it's weird. Cause I feel like I had the same thing with Force Awakens, whereas I really liked it the first time, but like I had misgivings. And then when I watched it the second time, I was a lot more receptive to it too. So I think the same thing will be happening here. I think it's just weird with Star Wars because I'm watching it, like I have a very specific idea of what I know Star Wars to be.
Right.
And, you know, when I see something new, it's almost like, that's not Star Wars. This is Star Wars. Like,
yeah, I think that's definitely a lot of people's knee-jerk reaction to something ubiquitous and important to people as Star Wars is. So I'm excited for Episode 8. I mean, obviously I'm excited for all these movies. But
yeah,
I think specifically Episode 8 because Rian Johnson is one of my favorite directors right now. And he's one of the most hardcore, like, visionary people.
Absolutely.
So to see his... Hopefully Disney lets him put his spin on Star Wars.
Yes. Yeah. Rogue One, really enjoyed it. A lot of fun. I'm hoping that future spinoffs, like the Han Solo one obviously is happening. But I'm hoping, and you know, they've talked about like there's rumors about an Obi-Wan spinoff and something like that with Ewan McGregor coming back to the role, which would be interesting.
Yeah. Now there's a push to have a young Leia one with Millie Bobby Brown as Leia.
I saw somebody tweet something like that, yeah, which I think she might be too young to play Leia at this point.
Probably, yeah.
But by the time they get around to making a young Leia spinoff, you know, who knows?
Who knows?
Because that would be like 6 or 7 years in the future if, like,
exactly.
Whenever. But in any case, I do hope that they kind of steer away from young versions of characters we know. And
yes.
Kind of follow the Rogue One model, but go even further with it. You know, have a movie that's completely disconnected from everything that happened in any of the original movies, you know?
Yeah, I would love to see, like, an Old Republic movie. Like, go to some other time periods that we have.
Go to some other time... Like, a Knights of the Old Republic movie would be cool, or, like, just some made-up story. I remember there was a long time ago when Star Wars was first announced to be under Disney, and they were talking... Like, everything was basically a pipe dream. Like, nobody knew what was happening.
Yeah.
We knew there was a new trilogy that was being made, and at a certain point, we knew that J.J. Abrams was making it, or J.J. Abrams was starting it. But we didn't know anything about the spinoffs. We didn't know anything about what it was going to be like. And one of the first rumors for a spinoff was that Zack Snyder was going to be directing a Seven Samurai remake in the Star Wars universe.
What?
Or essentially a remake of Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
And I think that would have been fucking awesome. I'm less high on Zack Snyder now than I was back then. But, you know, I think, you know, Zack Snyder, I don't trust Zack Snyder anymore after Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman.
No, he's gone. But that plot synopsis.
But that idea...
What are Jedi other than samurai?
Exactly. Like that would have been amazing. if there was anybody other than Snyder at this point.
Exactly.
Although, who knows about Zack Snyder? You know, I guess he's taking a break. Like he's doing Justice League, and I guess before he does the second Justice League, he's taking that got delayed to make room for Ben Affleck's Batman, and so he is going to be doing like an Afghanistan war drama or something like smaller scale.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that like revitalizes some creative juices in him because I liked Watchmen a lot and I liked 300 and you know I liked Dawn of the Dead, so like, you know, we'll see.
But hopefully the success of this, I mean, it's such a weird thing to say, like, because all these movies are going to break every record, like it's Star Wars. But how receptive people are to doing this other thing with the Star Wars universe, I hope they branch out. Like they've got 30 years of novels that are non-canon now, but.
Right.
You can mine for ideas and material and what to do and go to other time periods, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know everything about the extended universe, but I do know that certain things were remade canon through Rogue One. Like, I think Rogue One took some ideas from other novels and stuff, like the fact that the Death Star uses kyber crystals to power its super weapon or something. I think that's from a novel.
Also, if Death Star could travel in hyperspace, like, that shot was fucking dope. Like that's one of those the sheer, you know, like you said with scale, the sheer menace of the Empire.
Yes,
something the size of a moon traveling in hyperspace. Like,
yes,
badass.
Very, very cool. All right, so I think that about wraps it up for our Rogue One review. We've talked about it for quite a while.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else you wanted to add before we wrap this up, Mike?
No, I think we covered all of it. I do agree with you a lot that the theme of hope and you know being willing to go to whatever length. You know, if you never believe you can change anything, you would never fight for it.
Right.
And the whole rebellion is founded on that, and it's really powerful for what's going on today.
Yeah. And on that note, Mike, where can we find you online this week where you're complaining about Nazis on Twitter?
Yeah. Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, you can find those games. My friends and I post them at YouTube.com geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to FilmBookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike Tacrisio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. If you want to donate to our Patreon campaign, you can go to patreon.com/filmbook. You can do that there. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks, where we'll be taking a look back at 2016 with our top 10 films of the year, Mike. So
that's going to be tough.
That is very exciting. Maybe we can throw in another episode before that, because we're on this is episode 48 of the podcast, and it would be kind of cool if our year in review was episode 50.
It's episode 50.
Yeah, but because last year it was episode 25, and I'd like to keep that.
Aww.
And I'm OCD about that kind of thing. So.
Sure, why not?
Well, we'll see what happens. I don't know, because obviously it's Christmas and this
yeah.
difficult scheduling and stuff, and all the movies are being released
right.
in like a 1 week span, and like it's gonna be hard to see all of them. But that's it, cool. And if we get a chance, I mean, again, Christmas, so scheduling is gonna be weird. But if we get a chance, we'll do Complete Works next week, where we'll be talking about Nicolas Cage's role in Brian De Palma's Snake Eyes. So that's pretty cool too.
It is.
Yeah. All right. So thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out. That's a fucking squid. An evil alien squid. Join up ships. We got to let it rip. We got to blow that bitch to